Scripture reading today comes from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God.
Morning. Glad that you're all here today. We are entering into one of my favorite parts of the calendar year. Fall is an exciting time for me, just weather-wise, if nothing else. I like fall weather, but in church life, it's an exciting time for those of us who are in church ministry or in leadership, for elders and others. Can I be direct for a moment? Have I been here long enough that I can say something with candor and not have anyone set their hair on fire afterwards? In September and the first part of October is that golden window when everyone's back from summer vacation and hunting season hasn't started yet, and you actually all show up. Okay? Take that how you want. That's reality. There's this kind of golden window and everyone's here. And it's a time when we get to set out a fresh agenda of what we want to accomplish as a congregation. It's a wonderful time. It's an enthusiastic time. I hope you'll take a minute to look through the church bulletin, not while I'm preaching, but at another time. Look through the church bulletin. This fall, we are going to have as many opportunities for you to be involved in this congregation as at any other time in the calendar year. We have a magnificent list of classes coming up for the fall quarter, both on Sundays and Wednesdays and Sunday nights. We're going to be doing a well-prepared class from our teachers who have put in a lot of time on this on Hebrews on Sunday morning from fourth grade up. The teachers attended a workshop yesterday and got all excited and prepped on it, so they're ready to go. They're all ready to go. We have the opportunity. You want to learn New Testament Greek? That's been on your bucket list, right? Nick White is interested in teaching some New Testament Greek. We've got three volunteers already, so your class made. So we've got, if you want to interested in that, we've got that class available Sunday mornings. We have, on Sunday nights, Bruce Rothell is directing a class down the hall on evangelism coming up in September on the skill set that we need to be more outgoing in expressing our faith to other people and helping them come to Christ. That'll be down the hall. We really encourage that. Here in the auditorium on Sunday nights, we'll be talking about prayer. Wednesday nights, we have more classes. You can look at the roster for that. I know Randy's doing one. I've got one. We have some stuff going on. Hayden Brill, our youth intern, is now 2 weeks settled in and ready to get started. That's all going to be underway here in September. We have lots going on there. Monday night for the master is going to get started again in the coming weeks, hopefully, Lord willing. Need I say more? Friends and Family Day is coming at the end of September. We'll start advertising that soon. We have a Young Families Retreat in October, which is going to interfere with hunting season, and I don't care. We're doing it anyway. And we also have, what was the other thing in September? Totally just slipped my mind. There's another thing, and it's important, and you should read the bulletin, and it's in there. And tonight, one of our activities that's one of the options we're looking at for the church as a whole, and especially our young people, Todd Kempton is here and is going to give us a talk about Lads to Leader and how that might be an opportunity for us if we get involved in that in this congregation. So here's my point. This is the candor part. It wasn't actually about hunting season. This is the candor part. If you are not involved in what this congregation is doing starting this fall, it is not because there are not opportunities, and it's not because we're not doing God's work in this community. It's because you made a decision not to be involved. Okay? And we really mean that. The congregation has made an effort, the leadership has made an effort, to put out there as big a variety as opportunities for you to belong here, to learn here, and to serve here, like our bulletin says at the bottom every week, as we could imagine. And it's out there. Pick something. We don't expect anyone to do all the things that are out there. Look at the list. Find what interests you. How can you learn? How can you belong? How can you serve in this community, in this congregation? Pick something and get involved, because this is as good a time as there will ever be to do it. That's my candor for the morning. Let's look in Hebrews chapter 11. We're going to finish. This is the second part of a two-part sermon out of Hebrews. There's way more in Hebrews chapter 11 than we have time to possibly ever talk about. Even the writer of the book of Hebrews says there's more to talk about than he has time to talk about. We'll get to that in just a second, because he actually says that. The book of Hebrews, in case you didn't know, is a sermon. It's not an epistle like Colossians or one of the others. It's in written form, but it was preached. And the way we know that is because he says things like, "Oh, I'm running out of time," which is what preachers have been saying apparently for 2,000 years. We've been running out of time. That's not new. So it makes me feel good that he had that problem too. What we've been looking at in the book of Hebrews is this idea of faith and its role in the life of the Christian. The main and central problem of the book is stated, I think, best in chapter 2, verse 8, and that we mentioned last week, and I want to reiterate today. Because it's a contrast in the Christian life. Now, in putting everything in subjection to Him, He left nothing outside of His control. Okay, so that's the claim of Christianity. At present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to Him. That's the experience of Christianity. You see the difference? Here are the two things that are going on. In Christian life and faith and confession and worship, we believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. He is King of kings and Lord of lords. We believe in the reality of heaven's God and His reign here on earth. Listen to the songs we sing. We are standing on holy ground. We have come into His presence, right? Those are the songs we sang just this morning. That's the reality we believe in. But then we step outside the doors, or we show up on Monday morning, or do whatever it is we do during the week, and what do we actually experience? It doesn't feel like holy ground. It doesn't feel like we have approached God Himself or in His presence. It feels like God is very, very distant. It seems like someone else is running the show. And that's the problem that these Christians of the sermon, receiving this sermon in Hebrews, were facing, was that they were worshiping and praying and doing all the things Christians do, believing that Christ is ruler of all and everything is subject to Him. And yet there were Roman officials out here persecuting them and various other social influences that were making life very difficult to be a Christian. Violently difficult to be a Christian. How can Christ be in charge if it doesn't feel that way? So the book of Hebrews is this call to faithfulness, to continue to believe in the invisible reality professed by Christian faith. Hebrews chapter 11, which is what we're looking at, is this lengthy discussion of what faith is, of what faith looks like in human life, and in this litany of examples of our great moral heroes from years gone by who lived their life in faith. And we just don't have time to talk about them all, but we'll talk about a few. Start in verse 29 through 31. By faith, the people crossed the Red Sea as on dry land, but the Egyptians, when they attempted to do the same, were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. I like that little list. It's interesting. We usually spend more time on the other ones. Abraham and Moses get more time. But here's just an interesting group of three. Look at what faith is said to accomplish in these three examples. Number one, faith is walking on dry land in the midst of a sea. So they come out, the whole people of Israel, the slave people, the Hebrew people have come out of Egypt, and they come to the sea, and here comes Pharaoh's army. And not only do they not have an army of their own, even if they did, they would lose to Pharaoh, because this is what he does for a living. The Egyptians are powerful. Here they come, and there's the sea. And what are they asked to believe? That God will do something. And I suspect, as we read in the scriptures, not all of them were quite sure of that. Moses seems to be okay with it. And what took place was something they could not have possibly imagined. Put yourself there. Think of the possible solutions. Even include miraculous solutions. Think of the things in your wildest dreams that God does at this moment. Is even one of those that you thought of? Maybe He'll just move the sea. Maybe He'll just make a road right through the middle of it and we'll walk through. Is that as wild a possibility as you could ever have imagined? And yet that's exactly what happened. That the sea parted and they walked through, not just on the muddy bottom of the sea. They walked through on dry land. God made them a highway right through the middle of the sea. God did not just the impossible, the unimaginable. Because they took the time to stand there and wait for Him to do it. Because they believed. Faith is passing through impossible obstacles, like the persecution of the early church, like whatever obstacles are in your life today. Faith is possible, or makes possible that life, because it believes in the unseen, even unimaginable reality that God can bring about. Faithlessness is drowning. If you have the sensation of drowning, isn't that one we use? We use that terminology when you're overwhelmed and sin seems to be winning, or doubt and skepticism seems to be winning, or just life and all of its obstacles seem to be winning. We say, I feel like I'm drowning. And so did Pharaoh. And he was. Okay? Faithlessness is drowning. What you need is not a more practical response to those obstacles. What you need is more faith. What you need is not a better human solution for the obstacles of your life. What you need is more faith. Faith passes through the sea. Faithlessness drowns. And that's the way that God has set it up. The church, the early church that is hearing this sermon, felt like they were drowning. They were being persecuted in ways unimaginable to our comfortable and privileged modern society. They felt like they were drowning. The preacher says, pass through the sea and do it by faith. Faith brings down walls. Now, fear causes you to hide behind walls. A lot of human activity is motivated by fear and the desire to secure ourselves, okay, to make ourselves safe. One of the novel little stories that I don't have time to talk about, but I'm going to in just a minute anyway, in the Old Testament is the story of Cain. You remember Cain is banished from the people of Adam and his descendants, and he's sent off. And Cain says, this is more than I can bear. People are going to kill me. I'm in danger. This is Genesis chapter 4. And God says, well, I'll make it. I will give you my word. I'll make my law that people aren't allowed to kill Cain. So God gives his word. Nobody kill Cain. What does Cain do? Cain's not convinced. So if you keep reading in Genesis chapter 4, first thing that Cain does is build a city with walls. He builds a city, someplace where he can dwell secure and safe with his people. What do we do when we're afraid? Build some walls, right? Make ourselves safe and secure. We love security, okay? We hide behind walls in fear. But what does faith allow to happen? Faith causes walls to come down. The obstacles to what God has set before us comes tumbling down when in faith we do the seemingly unreasonable thing. In the history of military conflict, how many times do you suppose an army has marched around a wall and had it fall down? Is that a common one they study at West Point these days? Now, if you're come to a fortress, if you want it to fall, one option is to walk around it once a time, 7 days. And then they don't discuss that. That's not a valid solution to the problem of a fortification. That's not an option that anyone considers. It is like the parting of a Red Sea, an absolutely unimaginable response to faith. Which is exactly what faith gets. That's what this passage is teaching. Faith receives not just the invisible, the unimaginable. God is able to work out solutions to the problems we have in life, not only that we haven't come up with yet, that we could not have come up with, that in our wildest dreams we would not have guessed he would have done. And there we are, it happens. And the walls come down. Fear hides behind the wall. Faith causes the wall to come down. And don't miss the importance of the third one. You'd be tempted. Okay? Parting of a sea. Wall comes down. Rahab. Does this even seem the same magnitude? Right? Wall comes down. Sea is parted. Rahab survives. Does that seem like the same magnitude of event? Well, that's because we don't appreciate Rahab. Was it Mark Stinnett who did Rahab at our... summer series this summer from Illinois. He did a great job on Rahab. Go back and listen to this, but here's the short version. What happens in the life of Rahab is another one of these sea-parting, wall-crumbling, unimaginable events. How do we even know her? What is her title? Rahab the Harlot is how I grew up remembering Rahab, right? How is it that she survives in a book of faithful witnesses? Rahab's memory lives on. Doesn't just live on, thrives. She's in James chapter 2 as an example of faith in works. She's in the genealogy of Jesus Christ in the book of Matthew. She's in Hebrews chapter 11, sandwiched in between, you know, just those boring people like Abraham, Moses, Rahab. How does a prostitute live that kind of life? How does a prostitute find a place at all among God's people in the Old Testament? How does that take place? What I'm suggesting to you is that you should be more shocked by that verse than the Red Sea and the wall. Finding a prostitute in God's list of faithful witnesses is more likely than finding a jackalope on Elwood. It is unreasonable. It is ridiculous. It should not come to pass. And there she is. Repeatedly. See my point? She would never have imagined that her life could have been that significantly different. How was it different? By faith. The same way seas are parted, the same way walls fall, lives are dramatically and unimaginably changed and reshaped by the power of faith in the invisible God. And that's what we learned from Rahab. How many more stories could we tell like this from our scriptures? Ask the preacher, he'll tell you. Verse 32. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me. This is where I feel such commiseration with that first century preacher. Poor guy. There's someone at the back of the auditorium saying, is he really going to preach the entire Old Testament this morning? And he says, okay, I'll stop with Rahab, but let me just give you the short verse. And he says, time would fail me to tell you of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received back their dead by resurrection. Some were tortured, refusing to accept release so that they might rise again to a better life. Others offered mocking, flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned, they were sawn in two, they were killed with the sword, they went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, afflicted, mistreated, of whom the world was not worthy, wandering about in deserts and mountains, and in dens and caves of the earth. He says, yeah, if you gave me more time, that's what I'd tell you about. And all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better for us, that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. Look at the points he's making here. Look at what was accomplished by faith. These incredible lives that subjected the powers of the present age to the power of God by faith in the invisible God. All our great Bible heroes did it. Look at what was endured by faith. If you look at that list, it kind of falls into two halves. The first half is victorious. Look at all the good things happened when people were faithful. The second list is not. The second half of that list is, look at all the bad things that happened to faithful people. You went from conquering and stopping the mouths of lion to being sawn in half. What happened to that list? It took a bad turn, didn't it? But what the preacher is saying is, this is also the victory of faith. Faith is able to endure the unimaginable by conviction of the invisible. This is what faith is capable of doing. Look at what was not received. And this is the big point for us and for the audience of this text. None of them received a perfect utopian life. None of them received and saw in their human experience everything put to right. Some of them tasted of the goodness of God. Some of them saw things happen that they could never have imagined would happen. Some of them suffered terribly and did it faithfully just the same. But none of them, not a single person in your scriptures, gets to the end of the story and is living in perfect bliss in the presence of God, and everything's right and all the bad that was done is undone. All of them lived the same life you're living, which is this mixed bag of faith in the invisible and tolerance of what we actually see. Faith and conviction that God is just and right and He's making things right. But then the human experience of suffering, of illness, of sickness, of death, of turmoil, of persecution, of opposition, and the difficulty of life. Every one of them lived that opposition in their life. Every one of them lived that little paradox. None of them received everything. All of them trusted God would get there. But none of them saw it. What's the lesson for the suffering Christians of the first century? That's you. Jesus has come. Amazing things have happened in your life that has never heretofore been done. That's what verse 40 is about. Since God has provided something better for us, right? Christ has shown you more of what God is doing in the world than has ever been seen. And here's a hint. Jesus is risen from the dead. Now that's new. You want to see the unimaginable work of God? How about a Messiah who is murdered, brought back to life? You have seen more of what God is doing to put the world to right than anyone in human history has ever seen, because you've seen Jesus Christ. And yet still, we know that there's some of that that's not yet. Already, not yet. Some of that is still down the road. He says we're going to have to endure that in faith like those who went before us did. And if anything, it should be easier from us. He never says easy. No, no, no. Read the book of Hebrews. He never suggests persecution is easy. But he says faith makes it possible. And faith is absolutely necessary for that to be brought about. So his instruction then, having culminated this great story of faith, is to give them some instructions beginning in verses 1 and 2 of Hebrews chapter 12. In verse 1, he says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." What's his point? Number one, you are not alone. One of Satan's most crafty techniques is to convince you in your suffering and despondency and despair that you are the only one who feels like that. You are completely by yourself, and no one else is with you. What the preacher here says is you are not alone. You're not only with someone, you're with everyone. You are surrounded, blanketed by the faithful witnesses who have gone before. Whether you enter a Roman Colosseum or a judgment hall, or just the obstacles of ordinary life, you do not go there alone. Roman Catholicism has this about like 50% right. Can I give them a nod? They get half a star. Then I'm going to take it back. Okay. One of their big points of doctrine is that the saints go with you into life, and they are present with you in a meaningful way. I think according to Hebrews, they're entirely right. They just don't know what a saint is. A saint is not a special person that is selected out of church history to be an example for you. What we should say is what Hebrews says. You're not surrounded by a small select group of special Christians. You are surrounded by the entire mass of faithful humanity, of all God's people, of all of time, and they are with you when you go. When you face obstacles, they were there first. You are not alone. You are not the first. They are with you, surrounding you like a cloud. People you've known in your life, and you've all had, not just the faithful heroes of Abraham and Moses, you've known people in your life that encouraged you to faith. They're still there. The cloud of witness remains. Their life, their testimony to faithfulness and what it means and what it can accomplish remains. And they cheer you on in every obstacle of life, and they always will. We have to lay off the burdens then and move ahead into the task at hand. We can't pause at the brink and say, "I'm not sure if I can do this." The cloud of witnesses says, go. Go and face the obstacles of life. Lay off the things that would prevent you. Lay off sin that clings to you. Move ahead in faith into the obstacles of life and run with endurance. Endurance is his way of saying, no, it's not going to be easy, but it is going to be possible. This can be done. But there's one more thing. We're not done. Great cloud of witnesses, the whole mass and weight and momentum of all the faithful of history are at your side. But even that is not as important as the person who's out ahead. And that's in verse 2. looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Perfect faithfulness is modeled in Jesus Christ. He is the founder of faith, or we might translate the pioneer. He is the one who goes ahead. He is the one who has gone ahead and remains ahead. And we fix our eyes on Christ and his faithfulness, and he shows us the way forward in adversity. He is not some distant tyrant who tells us what to do. He is a loving and compassionate Lord who has already suffered everything we could ever suffer, who is tempted in all points like as we are, yet without sin, and now calls us forward up to the presence of God as the mediator of a better covenant. On Friday's cross, Jesus believed in Sunday's victory. He knew the power of faith to do the unimaginable, and it did exactly that. He is not here, but risen. Jesus is risen from the dead. And because of that compelling faith, he could look at the excruciating and incomparable misery of the death on the cross and despise it. What does that mean, by the way? This is a great final point for our sermon. Despising the shame. Something you despise is something you value as of nothing. Something that you give no concern over. Something that you look at and find to be trivial. Christ could look at the incredible, unmistakable, unspeakable agony of crucifixion and say, "I care not for that." What was his prayer? "If it be at all possible, let this cup pass from me. Not my will, but thine be done." He didn't want it. Nobody wants it. But if the choice was faithfulness in suffering or giving up and going home, Jesus knew the choice was faith. In our obstacles of life, no one has suggested to you, and if they have, fire them. No one has suggested to you that Christianity is easy. What faith tells us is that Christianity is possible. Endurance is possible. Because the invisible God with his invisible might has assured us of invisible victory. And he leads us ahead with his only Son, Jesus Christ. Fix your eyes on Jesus Christ and what he has accomplished, what he is still accomplishing today at the right hand of God, and pursue him through all the obstacles of life. Believe in the invisible reality of his victory in this miserable, visible world, and pursue him in faith. If you've not begun it, begin today in faith, in repentance, the confession of Christ Jesus, baptism into the invisible mystery of his blood, to begin that life of service to him in victory. As we stand and sing a word of encouragement, won't you come at this time?